working nowadays, yes. As I said, I'm standing before you with less prepared notes than I've ever done before. I'm standing before you with probably a most unusual set of thoughts about money that you might have heard of. They're a bit unusual to me as I was searching for what to share. And given that we're in the book of Matthew, but because money does matter to us. I think we'd all agree with that. Money matters to God. And what we do with our money matters to God. So it may be slightly uncomfortable, but this is actually an important topic because a lot's written about it. I'm a person who has lots of questions, as anyone who knows me will know. If I'd listened to that children's talk about David before, I would have thought, and I'd have been sort of focused on, why did David pick up 5 stones? Did he miss with the first 4? Did he think it was going to be a pride of lions? Was it force of habit? I don't know. But anyway, in keeping with the fact that I would much rather be talking about what is on your mind and what you find interesting than what I might think of, I actually want to hear your questions. And that's a serious invitation. If you don't ask me questions, I might ask you questions. So it's your choice. You will see that in the insert, as Trent already drew attention to it, the bottom half of this note is actually back and front a space for you to write questions. Now I'll give you an opportunity to ask questions out loud if you like later on, or you might like to write questions. We haven't forgotten about the offering. We're going to stick the offering right in the middle of the address. And that's to give you an opportunity to pass in questions too. But it's also a response in worship to what Jesus says about giving. And I think we're very fortunate because who better to listen to about money than the person who wrote more than all the other 3 gospel writers together, put together, about money. Matthew wrote more about money than all the other 3 gospel authors combined. Matthew, who had been called Levi, he was named then Matthew when he became a disciple. But he and Matthew, I love the name Matthew, won't surprise you. We named our son Matthew. But Matthew means a gift from God, which is also, I think, interesting in this focus on his previous life, focused on money, yet he was called a gift of God. And he focused on what we're to do with our possessions and money. He had a very keen ear to listen to Jesus about this topic. And he was actually sitting there as a tax collector. He was a Jewish tax collector. They were despised. He was sitting collecting taxes in Capernaum when Jesus called him to follow him. A tax collector was the person who actually acted on authority of Rome, the ruling, invading power. He collected taxes from his fellow Jews to pass on to the Romans. He had a very secure, financially secure life. He probably had more than enough for himself. He could certainly collect more than enough for himself. He could have been very generous. He could have given and provided for all that his family needed quite comfortably. I don't know for 1 minute whether he went into tax collecting because he loved the idea of it, or whether he was encouraged to do so by his family. Who knows? But in all probability, he could well have been a single man because many Jews so despised tax collectors that they wouldn't let their daughters marry them. So but that was the life of Matthew before. That makes, I think, him uniquely qualified on this topic to tell us what he thought about money. Well, more importantly, what Jesus said about money. Because he was transformed from presumably a lover of money, or certainly one who handled a lot of money, to a follower and then a disciple of Jesus. Of all the apostles, of all the disciples, early 12, his life was one of the most transformed, if you really think about it. And so I find him a very fascinating character. And this is fairly new to me, just to actually focus in much greater depth on Matthew and his life and his opinion, and what he actually saw as interesting. He is the only one, for example, of the four gospel writers who mentions the 30 pieces of silver that Judas was given. He's the only one to record the parable about the unmerciful servant who was forgiven a huge debt and then walked out and wouldn't forgive the person who actually had a small debt to him. He paid a big price for that, but Matthew's the only one who recorded that. He's the only one who recorded, as you'll see on the front of your bulletin actually, there's a reference to a Matthew chapter 17 about Jesus and someone asking, does he pay his tax? And then he asks, does the king need to pay tax? And the answer is obviously no, and the children of the king don't need to pay tax. But he didn't want to offend anyone, so he tells Peter to go and fishing and to find a coin in the mouth of a fish, and tells him to pay his tax and Peter's tax. Matthew's the only one who actually records that. The others don't. I think he's probably fascinated by that story, because it's one of the few times that Jesus actually does a miracle which actually serves some of his own needs to pay his tax. Although he wasn't obliged to, as the king, to pay tax, you might say. But enough of his credibility and natural interest in this topic. What does actually he say? Let's turn to that. More importantly, what does Jesus say about money as recorded by Matthew? And where does Jesus' view lie on the spectrum between those who think that all material possessions are evil and the embrace a vow of poverty and go and live in accordance with, as some Christians do, with a vow of poverty? And then there are the other extreme Christians who actually feel that God made us to travel first class, and we cannot outgive God. The more we give him, the more he'll give back to us. So there's a huge range of spectrum in Christendom of people viewing money and how we are to treat material possessions. Not surprisingly, I would argue that Jesus' view is somewhere in between those two extremes. Matthew first mentions money in chapter 6, when we're still in the Sermon on the Mount. And the very first thing he says about money is about giving to the poor. That's the first thing that Matthew records of Jesus saying about money. And he says, he doesn't say, if you give to the poor. This is in the first 6 verses. He talks about giving to the poor. He doesn't say if, he says when you give to the poor. It's a given. That he expected people to give to the poor. That wasn't something to be discussed. But how are we to give to the poor? When you give to the poor, Jesus said, you have to do so in secret. Not for the thanks and praise that you might get as a result. Don't go shouting about it. So that's the first reference. Then he digs deeper, which you'll find Jesus often does. He starts a topic and then he just digs deeper. And we get more and more uncomfortable maybe. But here Jesus digs deeper in verses 19 to 21, the same chapter 6 in Matthew, still in the Sermon on the Mount. And he draws a direct link between our hearts, our core priorities, and what we do with our money and other resources that we might have. Trent spoke on these verses a few weeks ago, but I think it certainly warrants further reflection as we talk about Jesus and money, speaking on money. Because what verse 19 to 21 says is, don't store up treasures here on earth, where moths eat them and rust destroys them and where thieves break in and steal. Store up treasures in heaven, where moths and rust can't destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. This actually link between treasures or our expenditures and our priorities or our heart goes both ways. Not only do we actually spend on what our heart tells us, but our observation of what we spend on tells us about what our priorities are. And that's what Jesus is saying. So it's important that we invest in what we invest in, what we focus on, what we spend on reflects our life priorities. And then in summarising that, they reflect our priorities, our heart, our expenditure pattern. And that be true, whether it be for a nation, and we've just had the budget this week, which I'm sure you're all fascinated by, and you won't be surprised that I'm distressed that we've yet cut further our aid to the poor in the world. And I'm distressed because our collective action in that regard will mean some people die in the world. Sorry, that's truth. As a church and as individuals, it reflects our priorities, what we spend our money on. So here, this is where it becomes uncomfortable. Jesus digs deeper. His question is very simple but direct. What do we treasure? What do we focus on? What are our priorities, our life priorities? Because they reflect what we worship. They reflect what's most important to us. Jesus then, still in the Sermon on the Mount, he then goes on and concludes by highlighting that each of us have a choice. It's a choice somewhat like Matthew had in saying that no one can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and man. Matthew responded to Jesus' invitation, come follow me. He walked away from financial security and a lucrative job. And lest you worry about this just being Matthew's perspective, he's not the only one. Luke, if you actually look over in Luke 13, he said, no one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and be enslaved to money. It's unusual for exactly the same words to be repeated by two different writers in Scripture. That verse and this verse are exactly the same. In a different context, by the way, and not the same. Luke's not recording the Sermon on the Mount when he records it. But so anyway, so that was Matthew made that response and that choice. We too must not worship money. It must not be an idol to us. Do we love God more than our financial security, our money, our possessions? I'm not suggesting at all that we all walk away from our employment. Please don't misunderstand me, as Matthew did. But we should actually, many of us, stay in our employment, be thankful for it, use it to support our families and the needs we have, and to support the church, and to be generous with the poor in the world. That's what God has done. Our faith and our focus on love for God and love for others must result in our being generous towards church and others, especially the poor. As I shared, I spoke on here in July, nearly 2 years ago, on stewardship. And you can look at some of the practical things that I tried to suggest then. We can go back and I can pull that address out if you like. But so I decided to do something quite different today, given that we're looking at Matthew. Jesus loved and he gave his all for us. We'll look at that a little bit further when we look at communion. But real faith gives rise to love, and love must be reflected in generosity. For every one of us who is fortunate enough to have anything to share, to give, and we all are in Austinville, we're blessed with much to share and to give. I think, as I shared nearly 2 years ago, we can give without loving, but I don't think anyone can love without giving. It's a challenge. Before turning to you for questions, I want to just share two other quick references of Jesus recorded by Matthew. And these are actually jumping way further in the book to chapter 22 and 23. In chapter 22, verses 17 to 21, we see the religious leaders questioning Jesus about paying taxes. Not surprising. The topic comes up again. And it's here where Jesus responds by, give to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and give to God what belongs to God. So yes, we're to pay our taxes. But if we're to give to God what belongs to God, we first need to know what belongs to God. And what does belong to God? When we are fully surrendered to him, The answer is all that we have and all that we are belong to God. That's true twice over, because we gave it when we surrendered our lives to him as believers, for those of us who are believers. And Jesus made us, God made us, Jesus made us, and he made all that we have and all that we are anyway. So in a sense, even if we weren't to give it back, he has granted us autonomy. We are but caretakers of what we call ours. Then, let's skip over one more chapter, chapter 25. And here, Jesus is warning about the religious leaders and teachers, which is a fairly common refrain too, and a variety of their practices. And in verse 5, Jesus actually makes reference to tithing. If you'd have asked me 2 weeks ago, before I started to prepare for this, did Jesus mention tithing, I'd have guessed wrongly and said, no, he doesn't. But actually he did. So I feel a bit surprised that I'd read it many times and didn't remember it, that he had done that. Look what Jesus said in response to these people. He said, what sorrow awaits you teachers and religious laws and you Pharisees, hypocrites, he calls them. For you are careful to tithe even the tiniest income from your herb garden, but you ignore the more important aspects of the law. And then what do you think he says? He doesn't say. He says justice, mercy and faith. That was his summary. That was what he highlighted out of the law. Justice, mercy and faith. You should tithe, yes, Jesus says. But do not neglect the more important things. In this, Jesus clearly says that these people anyway should tithe. These religious leaders of his day. That is, give 10% of their income back to God. And he says it as if it didn't really warrant discussion. It was a no-brainer, you might say. It's as if it was a given. But in typical fashion, Jesus doesn't stop there. Once again, he digs deeper and he lets us be perhaps more uncomfortable. It's easy to give 10% compared with some of these other things. It's easy to satisfy a rule. But he goes deeper in saying that we should not neglect the more important aspects of the law, justice, mercy and faith. This struck me as being really amazingly similar to what is recorded in Micah chapter 6 verse 8 from the Old Testament, which says, what is good? What is required of you? To do what is right, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. In the New International Version, it says, what does the Lord require of you but to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? Doesn't that sound a lot like mercy, justice, faith? I was really struck by the comparison. The matter of giving is between you and God. And he always knows of our circumstances. So don't feel badly if you are not able or you have little to give. The widow with the mite had little to give, but she was generous. He knows our circumstances. The important thing is that we give generously and cheerfully, seeing giving as a privilege, not a burden. It should not be out of sense of duty, but rather out of love for the Lord and the desire to see his kingdom advanced. And it should be seen as part of our worship to God. Giving is part of worship. We're going to turn, actually, and worship in giving shortly, as I invite people to collect the offering. But remember that our obedience and worship don't stop with giving. Jesus said that justice, mercy and faith are more important. Peace is pretty important too, but justice, mercy and faith. Giving is important, but being involved in the pursuit of justice, practice of mercy, a lifestyle of faith, are even more important. In the words of the Message translation, if you look it up, it uses fairness, compassion and commitment in this place. The absolute basics, it calls them, in place of justice, mercy and faith. And then it just left me wondering, how are we doing? How am I doing? as a community, as a nation, in terms of our fairness, our compassion, and our faith. That's where I wanted to pause and invite you to ask questions. There are many things. I've actually thought of a lot of questions I could actually ask you or I could ask myself. And there are a lot of principles we could follow. But I want to actually pause and actually invite the stewards to come forward and we'll collect the offering. Mainly not because this is just a response to what Jesus has instructed us, but it is part of our worship. And we are thankful for what God's blessed us with. So I'm not sure who's going to collect the offering. If you need a pen to write a question, I'm going to invite you to give questions to Trent or you to ask questions. Because I said I'd rather be actually speaking about what you are more interested in. And after we have a time together on this, we will actually share communion together. I'm not surprised. Lisa would have a question. And that sort of runs in the family a little bit. And Lisa, as you know, has worked and lived in the third world looking at poor and our response to poor poverty. But anyway, please just reflect on the this opportunity to worship in giving as we collect the offering. But if you're a guest here, please let it pass by. This is not a way of us taxing you for being with us. We love the fact that you're with us. Just enjoy this time together. And then if you want to put a question in the offering, we can pull that out of there too.
Watch me pull a question out of the offering bag. No, I'll gather them up and then if there's any questions from the floor, we'll do that first. I think it's starting with Lisa.
I don't promise to be able to answer all your questions. You may actually answer something that I'm not at liberty to ask something I'm not at liberty to answer. And I will be quite honest in saying if I can't answer something, I'll invite anyone else who wants to try and answer it to do so. But I want to actually spend the next 5 or 10 minutes on things that are really important to you, not my guessing what's important to you.
Okay, first question from family.
All right, so this is not planned at all. In fact, when I said I had a question, Mum said, write it down and I'll vet it. And I said, no. I think we're probably all familiar with that verse about the root, the love of money being the root of all kinds of evil. And I think we all sort of struggle with that verse that you highlighted about it's impossible to serve God and to serve money, because it's also fairly natural for most of us, all of us, to love money to some extent. So the question I have for you is, given that we all love money to some extent, what is something that you do personally to keep that love corralled and under control, I guess, so that that love of money doesn't run away with you and feed that roots of all kind of evil?
Whoa. I've got several questions that have come forward here. I'm not sure whether there are other ones that people want to answer or whether we want to collect questions or go one by one. Yeah, I've been privileged to have and to now have more money than we need for our own family needs. So actually I give a lot to our children. That's how we... In all jokes aside, it has been in our practice ever since I had a salary, which I haven't had a salary for some years, but to actually create a separate bank account and give away a bottom line of 10% of what I earned. But if you had asked me, do I tithe? I said, no, I don't tithe. I don't think it's a legal requirement to tithe, but I do give away a considerable amount, and it's a joy to be able to do it. It's a privilege. And that does build your interest in what you're giving it to. So you actually are more focused on your church if you're buying into the church. You're more focused on partners dealing with poverty in a global context if you're contributing money to that cause. And whether it be locally, whether it be the Lismore Soup Kitchen, whether it be Bruce in the high school, whether it be the equivalent in Ballina. But I think it is a matter of personal choice to actually struggle against the temptation of self-indulgence with money when we have more than we need. And yes, it is relative. People could look at us and say, well, you and Marilyn went on a trip to Europe last year, and yes, we did, and we enjoyed it. I think it's honouring to God to enjoy what he did, but I think we're also called upon to be generous with what we have. So no, I'm not perfect. I haven't embraced poverty to give away everything that I could give away, but it's an effort. It's an honest effort to try and maintain a balance and live a balance and actually do what I can. I don't know how many of us have actually signed a pledge or done anything this week since the budget to protest. I have. The outcome of our budget this week. I was in Canberra in December arguing with politicians about our aid budget. That's a privilege to me to be able to do that. So yes, and we actually went in when we had three little children, aged 1, 4 and 6 at the time, we went to live in Bangladesh because we felt compelled to actually try and do something different for the poor. We were privileged to have secure income, which I actually walked away from in Canberra to go to Bangladesh. And it was a genuine effort. I'm not sure it was all that successful to try and contribute to the world's poor, but that's where we spent the next 20 years of our life, working for the poor.
Good question. Good family question. It's good because we live in a culture that is highly money-focused and materialistic, and it's good to think about what are ways to think about how our heart might be captured by those things and do things actively against not getting caught in that. Catherine, you're...
Yes. I've been praying every day, and it's a personal thing, but I think it's between you and God what you want to give. Everyone has a budget, but it's between you and God what you think. It's not a question, it's just something to think about.
Okay, we'll take that as a statement from Catherine. Thank you very much.
I think that's totally consistent with what I also said.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yep.
We're in fact told not to go shouting what we give,
yep,
because we don't do it to seek praise.
Yep. Catherine, I think Paul reminds the Corinthians too to set aside money that he has and asking them to collect money. So when he gets there, to do that. So to think about that beforehand as well. So thank you for that. Any other questions? I've got the microphone. Oh, yes, okay, over here. And have you got...
I've got several questions written down here that we're going to go to.
Just one thing that comes to my mind in thinking about this aspect is where God, speaking to his people, he says, "You have robbed me." And the people said, "Where have we robbed you?" And God says, "You have robbed me with tithes and offerings." Could we clarify something in that area, what tithes is and then the offerings?
Mm-hmm. So picking up an Old Testament quote, do you know where that's from exactly?
Yeah.
No, okay.
Yes, that's when people weren't complying with a directive. Yes, you have robbed me. Well, I go to a couple that are here then. One is, what's written here is, how is giving an investment in heaven? Good question. Because not immediately obvious. But sorry, I wanted to go back to what Colin was saying too about what we give. I'm struck by all the things in Matthew. If you go to Matthew 25... in his portrayal of the final judgment, it is really challenging when Jesus says to those on his right who say, "When have we given to you, fed you? When have we given you a drink? When have we visited you? When have we clothed you?" And he turns to those, the righteous on his right, and he says, "Whenever you have done it to the least of one of these, whenever you have given to the poor, whenever you have clothed, whenever you have given them drink, when of you have visited someone in prison, when of you have given water, when you have done it to me, come and enjoy your inheritance." So he's actually even equates our generosity to the poor and our care for the poor as something. So I wondered how often or how long it is since some of us have gone through. I'm sure Elaine went through her wardrobe this last few weeks as they moved house. And gave away the clothes they don't use so they can be used by someone who needs them. And some of it's very simple, basic stuff. It's not grand, world-changing stuff. It's all incremental on the margin. But sorry, how is investment? How do we invest in heaven? I think that illustration from what Jesus talks about there in Matthew 25, in an illustration of heaven, that we are actually caring for the poor. But also in terms of the advancement of the kingdom, it is God's agenda. We want to live and respond to a godly worldview. And that involves, yes, supporting our church. It involves, we cannot function here without paying some people's salaries the way we do. And we need contributions to do that. And that's a very practical bottom line. I think investing in the lives of others and trying to meet their spiritual need is clearly an investment in heaven. Because some of those people that we try and reach out to and you share God's love with is an investment in those people, but it's an investment in heaven as well. So I think giving, it's a very good question, and it's not a simple cookie cutter answer. There isn't one. But do you want to add more to that one, Trent?
I was just going to say, Lloyd's made himself very vulnerable up here because he's having a chance to answer any our question. He has the right to say, I'll get back to you on any of those, any of the questions that he doesn't feel that he has an adequate answer for. I think Colin's main point is what's the difference between the tithe and the offering? Is that right?
Oh, so okay. I didn't understand it that way.
Did you have anything to comment on that?
I think most New Testament scholars would say we are not bound to tithe. But they would argue that we are bound by the law of love to be very generous. And I don't draw a distinction between a tithe and an offering. I think we are generally called to be very generous and give very generously, which basically probably starts with 10%. Doesn't stop with 10%.
It'd be interesting to see, actually, to think about those two words and how they're used in the New Testament. Obviously, in the Old Testament, or that idea of tithe, which Jesus just points out there, they tithe their mint in a percentage of a certain amount. But an offering is probably the free will offerings and the other offerings which are described in the law, which I assume that would be referring to, as in it's either a free will offering or a drink offering. Is different to the tithe there, but I'd have to have a look myself as well. Good question.
And now I understand that it is. So a couple other things here that I've got in front of me I want to touch on.
On one and then we might have to finish or people get back to you.
I've got two. I want to come back to communion. But someone said, does Jesus stand on superannuation and health and life insurance? That's a good question. And some Christians would say, no, God provides for tomorrow. You don't need to worry. But I think God has primarily provides for tomorrow by you being responsible with the gifts he's given you today. And God provides for other people tomorrow by what you do with your income today. So I think we should participate in superannuation. I think it's appropriate to have life insurance when you have young families. I don't think we don't have life insurance anymore, but we did when we had young children. Then it also says if the government is stepping back in welfare to others, I think should we as a church step up? I think it's beholden on us to step up in terms of advocacy and planning. I think it's great that we are as generous as we are with Link, with meals and so forth. And I think it's important that we do that. Our support for the Lismore Soup Kitchen is important, which is something that people in this church have supported for a long time. I think we do need to do those things, yes. But I'm not suggesting that we become a major food bank or start an initial thing, but there's lots we can do in advocacy, and you can come and see me more about that if you like afterwards.
Thank you for participating in our interactive time. So I appreciate that. I'll hand back to you, mate, to lead us into our Lord's Supper time as well.
Thanks. I did have a lot of possible questions there, principles to follow, what Jesus expected of us. There's principles which were much more akin to what I spoke about nearly 2 years ago. And then there were a whole lot of possible questions that I thought of if you didn't have any. And But then I wanted to come on to communion because, as I suggested earlier, and I reminded us, reminds you of the fact that Jesus gave his all for us. And once again, we go back to Matthew for a couple of quotes as we lead into communion. Right at the start, when he spoke to, before he was born, you will have a child. You will call him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. And that's the bridge Jesus built with his death on the cross. We actually celebrate that as we reflect on the reality of Jesus' provision for us. The fact that he took upon himself our punishment in separation from God. The fact that he actually laid down his life for us. And then it steps across. Because he didn't stay dead, he rose from the dead. What a glorious celebration. And what an underpinning of our hope for the future. He has authority to say that we have a future too. And part of that is a presence. Now, he promised later in Matthew, I will be with you always, even to the end of the age. What an incredible comfort that he will walk with us through the difficulties of life, just as he did with the men who walked through the fire, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego. Just as he did with other people in difficulties, just as he does today when we encounter difficulties that we don't understand. But Jesus is with us. But just let's reflect briefly on that as we come to this celebration, the celebration of a new covenant that Jesus actually provided for in his death and in his resurrection. In 1 Corinthians we read, on the night when he was betrayed, the Lord took some bread and gave thanks to God for it, and he broke it in pieces. This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, he took the cup of wine after supper, saying, the cup is a new covenant between God and his people, an agreement confirmed with my blood. Do this in remembrance of me as often as you drink it. For every time you eat this bread and drink this cup, you're announcing the Lord's death until he comes. I'm struck by the fact that Jesus, as symbols of his death, he chose something we do every day. Chose something that the poor, the rich, every person, everywhere does. We all drink and we all eat every day. He didn't choose when you actually go for a 5K run, remember me? Or when you go exercising, swimming, or anything else. He chose two of the most basic things of life. He chose them as symbols to actually remind us constantly of his sacrifice on our behalf and the new covenant he ushered in doing that. Let us pray. Loving God, we praise and thank you for your love shown to us in Jesus Christ, acknowledging that it cost you dearly. We thank you for this sacrificial death upon the cross, for the redemption of the world and for each of us individually, and for rising from to life again and the glorious hope that that provides us with because you rose to life again. We give you thanks for this bread and this wine as you remember what your sacrifice has made possible for each of us. We have a hope and a future because of what you have given us in Jesus. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May he give you peace. May God, the source of hope, fill you completely with joy and peace because you trust in him, knowing he is with you always to the very end of the age.